Hi, this is Bill Meyer. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. You can hear the show every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 12 noon Central, and there are many more podcasts for this and all of our other faith radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
He's a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
And welcome. It's so great to have you with us here on this Saturday in the Upper Midwest. We appreciate you making Faith Radio part of your weekend. Today, we're going to dive into the topic of apologetics, but from a very different perspective than you might be used to. If you've read much apologetics, perhaps C.S. Lewis, Josh McDowell, Rabbi Zacharias, you know that there are some classic arguments and ways to defend the faith. But what about our experience? What about whether seeing really is believing? What we experience in this life, our intuition, our experiences with other people, with creation, what can that tell us about the Christian faith, about the existence of God? We're going to be talking to one of the world's foremost apologists, Dr. James Sire, who you may know from his classic book, The Universe Next Door. He's written a new book called Apologetics Beyond Reason, Why Seeing Really Is Believing. He's going to join us in just a few minutes and unpack this topic. And I find it interesting, you know, I've kind of delved into apologetics a bit over the years, and I know some of the arguments. I'm certainly not a pro at it, not an expert at it. But Dr. Sire, in his later years, has come up with this new concept of, you know what, as human beings, we can discern certain things just through life that tell us that there is a God. And we'll find out more about that here in just a bit on the Faith Radio Network. Well, the school year is kicking off. A lot of school districts, at least here in the Twin Cities, are starting up this coming week. Maybe school has already started in your community. And as school gets underway, one of the things that I'm often asked as a family psychologist is, how do I protect my kid from being bullied? You know, bullying is unfortunately more and more prevalent in our society, and certainly in our public schools, and unfortunately in many Christian schools. Yes, kids are bullied in Christian schools. What a concept. And I often receive emails and get questions from parents about bullying. And so I thought maybe this week and perhaps next week we would dive into this topic a bit, because again, it is a hot button issue for a lot of parents, especially parents who may have kids in middle school and high school. Bullying does occur in elementary school settings, but you know, with those younger kids, typically the teachers, principals have a lot more control, and they're often just in one classroom. But one of the questions that often comes up is, what causes a child to bully other kids? And you know, we used to think that bullies were children who had low self-esteem. In fact, maybe when you were growing up, You might have heard your teacher say, well, the reason bullies pick on other kids is they don't feel good about themselves. And because of that, they want to make other kids feel bad. It seems logical, stands to reason. But actually, the latest research shows that in many cases, just the opposite is true. In fact, many bullies have an overly inflated sense of self-esteem. They are, in effect, narcissistic. They feel so highly about themselves that, you know what, they go, I can do whatever I want. And oftentimes what they want is to pick on other kids to feel powerful, and they derive pleasure out of victimizing other children. So it's not that these kids you know, have this low self-esteem, so they want attention to, you know, by picking on others. No, they think they're pretty hot stuff. And they think, you know what? I'm the king of this playground. And I'm gonna pick on whoever I want, especially if they're bigger, stronger, more physical. And certainly family dynamics have a lot to do with this. That's a whole nother topic. But I think it's important for parents and teachers to know that these are not just little kids who, you know, are feeling sorry for themselves and acting out. They're often kids that are already going down the path to narcissism. Now, another question I'm asked is, are some children more likely to be victimized by a bully? Well, yes, the research actually shows that bullies target children with certain characteristics. They tend to pick on kids who are perceived as different from their peers in some way. For example, maybe a child who is overweight or a child who's underweight, a child who is extremely tall or extremely short, a child who wears glasses, a child who dresses in an odd way. Bullies also tend to zero in on kids who they perceive as weak or unable to defend themselves, kids who are loners, don't have many friends, kids who are depressed or anxious or who have low self-esteem themselves. Now, something else, and I think parents need to be aware of this. This is really critical. Bullies will often target kids who don't get along well with others. Children who are viewed as annoying or irritating by their peers are more likely to get picked on by a bully. So, mom and dad, if you have a child who's annoying and irritating when he gets around other kids, maybe your son or daughter needs some social skills training and learn how to get along with others and make friends, because unfortunately, they may be the one that the bully zeroes in on. Now, next week, I think we're going to talk a little bit about what do you do if you find out if your child has been bullied. What are some of the red flags that the parents can look for if they suspect their child has been bullied? And I'm also going to get into a faith perspective on bullying. What should our responsibility be as Christian parents in teaching our kids to not just be bystanders, but to be alongside standers? That is a term that has been coined by Paul Coughlin, who is one of the leading Christian authorities on bullies. If we believe, as we certainly should, that all human beings have worth and value and are worthy of dignity and respect, then we should not allow any person to be picked on, to be bullied, to be disrespected, to be harmed in any way, whether that's physically or emotionally. And therefore, as Christian parents, I believe we should be encouraging our kids to not just stand silently by when another child is victimized. And we'll talk about some of the strategies that Paul Coughlin uses with his organization called the Protectors. And we'll get into that just a bit next week. Well, it's 11 past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Bill Meyer, and coming up next, we are going to get into apologetics from a very different perspective. We typically focus on reason and rational arguments. What about experience? What can our experiences teach us about the existence of God? We'll talk to Dr. James Sayer up next here on the Faith Radio Network.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
Hey, welcome back. We appreciate you joining the conversation today and making Faith Radio part of your weekend, regardless of whether you are listening in Madison, Wisconsin on Faith 1190. Maybe you've got us in Sioux Falls, South Dakota on Faith 1270 or in Fargo-Moorhead on Faith 1200. Beautiful Duluth on the shores of Lake Superior. Maybe you're listening on Faith 90.5. Faith 1090 in Waterloo, Iowa, or right here in the Twin Cities on our flagship station, Faith 900 in Minneapolis, St. Paul. Thank you for taking us with you this weekend. Joining us this morning is Dr. James Sayer, one of the best-known authors on apologetics and the Christian faith. Dr. Sayer has been an officer in the Army. He's been a college professor, chief editor of InterVarsity Press. He's been a lecturer at over 200 universities in the United States, Canada, Eastern and Western Europe, and Asia. Quite a globetrotter. He is the author of 20 books on literature, philosophy, and the Christian faith. His book, The Universe Next Door, was published first in 1976, now in its fifth edition. It has sold over 350,000 copies and has been translated into 19 foreign languages. And today he joins us to talk about his new book from InterVarsity, Apologetics Beyond Reason, Why Seeing Really Is Believing. And Dr. Sire, welcome to Faith Radio.
Well, good morning, and it's good to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Thanks for spending part of your Saturday with us. And, you know, before we dive into your new book, it's likely that some of our listeners aren't familiar with your classic, The Universe Next Door. Could you give us an overview of that book and maybe some of the key arguments you make? Because I think it's a book that every Christian should have in their library.
Well, first of all, it looks at the beliefs around the world and puts them into a category called worldviews, which allows us to look at the most foundational beliefs that people have and how they relate together, how they are integral, and make a worldview that is distinct, say, from another worldview. Universe Next Door starts off with the dominant worldview of the 16th and 17th, and actually before that, the medieval ages, that is the Christian worldview, and then looks at the way in which the Christian worldview has, first of all, decayed and how other worldviews have begun to replace it between those years and these. And the sequence is something like this. First of all is Christian theism in a relatively orthodox, but also rather a number of different ways it can be understood, but in at least a essentially central notion that is summarized, if you will, briefly and quickly by the Apostles' Creed and the implications that has. Then comes the erosion of that worldview in deism. Deism still believes in God, but God loses, if you will, or is denied his personality, and you have a rather abstract conception of what God is. A lot of the founding fathers were in this mode. Some were not, some were, but they had, and other philosophers too at the time, in the 18th century and so forth.
What was the? Let me ask you, as far as deism, and I know Thomas Jefferson was known as a deist, and we have the Jefferson Bible where he actually cut out all the references to anything supernatural, any of the miracles. What was it that led to this deistic viewpoint? Was it the advance of science and these intellectuals who said, wow, God, we just can't really believe all of this miraculous stuff?
Well, that's certainly part of it, and perhaps it might even be the most significant part. It's the part that I identify in The Universe Next Door. There's also a draw. And Charles Taylor, in his book, The Secular Age, emphasizes the draw towards something else. And the draw, if you lose God, what do you get? Or if you lose the power of God or the presence of God in personal reality, what do you get? Well, you get yourself. Mm. And you get to make up your own mind. So one of the reasons that we have moved from a completely Christian understanding of the world to a deistic understanding is that science has given us a way to understand the material world in a way that the Christian faith at the time did not was not looking into. And then you lose that, you not only lose gain that, but you also lose the need, or so it is argued, the need for a personal God. Man can stand on his own, and you get what I call the autonomy of human reason. That is, we trust our own reason. Deism is the beginning of our trust in our own reason. And when we begin to trust in our own reason too much, if our successes lead us to think that we're going to be successful in answering all the questions by reason, then what do we need God for?
And did many of the founding fathers have that viewpoint that, hey, look, we're pretty hot stuff. Look what we're doing. We're putting together this whole new concept, this thing called democracy and this republic, something that's never happened in the history of the world. We can do it on our own. We really don't need, you know, maybe God created the world, as I think Jefferson would agree to. But, you know, he's not involved in our daily affairs anymore. We've pretty much We're in charge.
Well, I don't want to badmouth the founding fathers, even the deists, quite so profoundly. I think it is a temptation that all of us have to think we can go on our own, especially in the position that we're in now, where so many people have so many different views. Why not mine? But yes, there's something, of course, to that. And many of the deists of the time still were what I call warm deists. That is, they still believed in a personal God. They believed in providence, but they didn't believe in that relationship between Christ and the individual person whereby we have that personal relationship. That was not there. But God as directing history was there. But if you get rid of that kind of God, then you have a kind of pure naturalism, and science replaces both, if you will, revelation and tradition as authorities in what we are going to believe, and you get this pure kind of we're only on our own, and we're on our own only because we are material beings and there isn't anything else in the universe, so there's no one else to turn to. So therefore, we must use our own reason, and in fact, we do a rather good job of that. Well, that held for a long time, and in fact, it's still the dominant worldview in the universities. But in the 19th century, that got to be doubted itself. And a number of people, key figures in the 19th century, began to say, wait a minute, we really want answers to these big questions, and like, what is the meaning of life, and why is there anything rather than nothing, and questions that science simply cannot address. And they became, like Nietzsche, nihilists, people who thought, well, there really isn't anything but ourselves around, and the first response is, we're in very, very bad trouble. But then Nietzsche, of course, said, well, since we're in this kind of bad trouble, each one of us can be the captain of their souls, and we don't need anyone else than us, and we can do it. But, of course, what that does is lead to a kind of anarchy and chaos. It doesn't provide any kind of social cohesion that we have to have to glue ourselves together. So that's been a constant threat from the 19th century right up till today, and it's answered in a variety of ways. Those who think that, no, actually human beings are good enough to go on there alone, they're the existentialists among us, or we say, well, we don't have anything better. We're just going to have to gut it out. We'll be secular humanists, with recognizing we can't all answer all the questions, but we can answer enough, and that's all we've got to go with. So, you know, gut it out.
Now, in the last, let's say, generation, what changes have you seen or made to that classic book based on postmodernism, based on some of the prevailing worldviews that we see in academia today? Have you had to go back and say, okay, some of these foundational principles still hold, but now there are some that are even denying the existence of any objective truth?
Yes, well, I would say that a good deal of the postmodern effect has been to say, we will just live with what we can make do with, and if we can come up with a theory or a process or an understanding that gets us what we want, pragmatic, gets us what we want, we don't really need anything more. If our science leads us to the moon and we want to get to the moon, then our science is sound. If our science leads us to do something like create a bomb that destroys us all, well, so much the worse for us, but there really isn't anything we can do about that, excepting work hard against these sorts of things which are desperately face us, like the Middle East crisis today. What do we do about that? That lack of confidence in the human mind of finding anything really real in the world, in other words, really knowing anything as it is, truth as discovering the way the world is, that has been undermined significantly in practically every other field in the university excepting science and technology. Science and technology, science works fine for them, gets them what they want. But when we try to ask these questions about who are we as human beings, is there anyone we are responsible to at all? Are we really responsible? You were talking about responsibility of the child to the parent to the child. Why? And so we face those issues, and we don't have any really good answer unless there's something transcendent that will undergird our thinking and give us foundation for thinking. And maybe some of our thinking is really we can actually see the truth.
Mm. Now, in the universe next door, do you come to that final conclusion that without a transcendent source of truth, without a God, as you said, it leads to chaos and anarchy and anything goes?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I don't do an awful lot with that. I just trace the history and provide a way, if you will, a heuristic way, a way of understanding views of others than ourselves. You ask 7 or 8 questions, and if you know the answers to those 8 questions for yourself, you know what you believe. And if you can answer that for your neighbor or for, let's say, a typical Muslim or a typical Hindu, then you understand something of those things that are similar to yours and those things that are radically different.
Mm. Well, I would commend all of our listeners, if they've never read The Universe Next Door, and is it now in its fifth edition?
Fifth edition. Probably 400,000 now in print or out there.
Well, that is amazing. A real labor of love for you and a classic. I remember when I was working at Focus on the Family, their Focus Institute, where they brought in young people, college students, to be trained in worldview and family studies. That was one of their core texts. And I recall one day I was down in the Institute offices, and they were just about to start off a new semester, and I saw about 100 copies of The Universe Next Door sitting in boxes ready to be distributed to these young people who were there to strengthen their faith and learn Christian worldview. So my hat's off to you for just a wonderful, wonderful book. And, of course, you've written so many others on apologetics. And we're going to dive into your new book from InterVarsity Press here in just a bit, which is a bit of a departure for you and something that I think may surprise some of those that are familiar with your work or some folks who have read apologetics in general. I mentioned at the top of the program, some of our listeners have read C.S. Lewis and Josh McDowell, Ravi Zacharias, and some of the other apologists. And this is a little different tack, which I think our listeners will enjoy. We also have 4 copies of Dr. Sire's book to give away. And if you call us in the next 30 minutes and give us your contact info, we will put you into a drawing for a copy of Apologetics Beyond Reason, Why Seeing Really Is Believing. So give us a buzz. Our number is 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH. And we'll put you into that drawing at the end of the hour for 1 of 4 copies of Dr. Sire's book. This is the Faith Radio Network. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Dr. James Sire here on Faith Radio. Stick with us.
And we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
Welcome back. So great to have you with us today. We're just a few weeks away from the Faith Radio Full Pledge Drive, known as SHARE. And in fact, just a couple of days, we're going to be asking you to prayerfully partner with this ministry to continue to let us be salt and light here in the upper Midwest and around the world through the internet. And, you know, would you really consider prayerfully partnering with this ministry this year? If you have supported Faith Radio in the past, you have been instrumental in keeping us on the air and changing lives through the relevant Bible teaching, through the family-focused teaching on this network. And you can actually sponsor a full day of broadcasting on Faith Radio for $100 a month, just about $3 a day. And you can actually choose the day. the reason for dedicating a particular day, and we will honor you or your ministry, your church, or an event. You can sponsor a half day of broadcasting on Faith Radio for $600 or $50, $50 a month, and you can choose the day, the morning, the afternoon. Kind of a cool thing that we're doing this year. So we would encourage you to join us for Share September 9th through the 12th. You will hear more in the coming weeks. You'll hear Austin Hill talk about it during the morning show. Certainly Neil Stavem in Connecting Faith and Susie Larson's program in the afternoon. We'll be talking about Share as we gear up for this this wonderful opportunity for you to make a difference in the lives of people all throughout the Upper Midwest. Well, my guest today is Dr. James Sire. He is one of the best-known authors on apologetics and the Christian faith. He wrote the classic book, The Universe Next Door, first published back in 1976. And today he's joined us to talk about a new book that he has from InterVarsity Press called Apologetics Beyond Reason, Why Seeing Really Is Believing. And Dr. Sire, you mentioned that up until recently, you were someone that was somewhat reticent to write about your own religious experience. Why was that?
Well, I've been impressed, of course, by other people's stories of conversions and religious experience, but I've never really thought that I had much to share on that. I would tell my story every once in a while, but mostly I was interested in giving what I would consider sort of solid reasons that are not just my own subjective experiences. But that's kind of changed.
And you actually mention in the book, you say, I have been a child of Descartes. explain a little bit about your early experience in grappling with the faith and what happened to you and what you learned.
Well, I've been a child of Descartes, but I have denounced my father. How's that?
I love it.
I think that what I wanted was what Descartes wanted when I was a youth. And I mean from very early, probably high school, all the way up until I began to change my mind. But Descartes was the one who thought that he could demonstrate for absolute certitude that it could not possibly be wrong at all that God existed, and he did that by starting with the notion that he couldn't be wrong about he existing, because if he was conscious, if there was anything there at all, then there must be something, and to explain that something, he knew he couldn't explain it on his own, that he didn't uphold himself in existence, and so there must be something that upholds him, and that's God. That sounds pretty solid until you look into the details of that and discover that, and Descartes talked about this, but he didn't really take it as seriously as he should have, the I that you think you are could be the I that is dreaming. And if you're dreaming, you're not what you think you are, and you're also not in control of who you are. You're misunderstanding from the very beginning. And where can you go with that? So Nietzsche tore this apart, this argument apart in the late 19th century. And following him and others and so forth, that particular justification for the existence of God and even of oneself, it's just too flimsy. The much different it is to recognize that we who are what we are owe our existence to somebody who's really brought us into being, and it is his existence that precedes our existence that allows our existence to exist. And if this being who is that sort of being is also the being that we understand to exist through Scripture and through Revelation and through the experience and thoughts of others, if that's the God who really exists, then my reasoning is possible. And the explanation for why I make mistakes is also possible, because I find myself in divided from this God who has brought me into being, and my image of that I have of him has been distorted not enough to keep me from being able to think, but enough to keep me from being able to think with complete accuracy. In fact, allowing me to think about myself things that I ought not to think about myself, that I am really in charge. So I think we just have to believe with this kind of notion that there is, in fact, a God. Now, we can't prove it, but if God is there, that's the presupposition. If that kind of God is there, then we're going to be able to experience him. We're going to be able to know him because he wants us to.
Now, you say in the book that really everything that exists is an argument for the existence of God. Now, what do you mean by that? Do you mean that what we perceive around us, the created order, our human body, our relationships, that all of that is really an apologetic?
Whatever exists, exists by virtue of there being a God who brought it into existence. God is self-existent, but if God exists, he exists in his own, he exists in himself. But the universe is created, its existence is dependent upon God, and God is the only one who can really, whom we can best, at least best understand as the one who gives us our being, our existence.
Then how do you respond to the very radical, you know, the person who sees Darwinism as their own religion? Do you believe that in recent years that theories like intelligent design have kind of blown evolutionary theory out of the water? That at least the part, the random selection, that the fact that we're all just, you know, an accident, we evolved from slime through random chance. Do you believe that kind of is going by the wayside, given what we've experienced and learned just in the last couple decades?
Well, what I believe is that there are a lot of my friends who believe that. There are a lot of my friends who don't think that intelligent design as a theory is quite valid. But what do I believe? I believe that there are a lot of people who disagree on this subject, and I'm going to let them duke it out.
But
I get criticized from both sides for failing to take a stand. What do I believe? I believe God brought this universe into existence. Period.
And so when you're talking to someone who says no, it's just all random chance, it came from nothing and spontaneously there was matter and substance, and then from there compounds came together, and from there life spontaneously arose, what do you say to that person? Because that person would doubt the existence of God. I guess you keep going back and back, and you say, well, where did this stuff come from? It had to come from someplace. Is that the best argument we have?
I think the best argument we have for the beginning of the beginning is the beginning that has no beginning. And you can't get that through rational thought. In other words, you can't argue yourself back to what is behind the whole thing. The question, why is there anything at all, that's been asked since Leibniz and before, for that matter. And the answers that the scientists give is, we can trace, or at least some scientists, we can trace the origin of our particular universe back to this time when things seem to suddenly emerge. But when you look at what the scientists who think they're philosophers say, is that's nothing. Well, it isn't nothing. It's the law or the explanation that has to precede it. Krauss's book on this subject, an atheist who makes this argument from nothing, that the universe began from nothing. It isn't nothing that he's talking about. It's something. It may not be a piece of material. It may not look like what we look like or anything else in the universe looks like. But it's something there that made the change. So nothing is never nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing
mm-hmm.
comes from nothing. And if you deny that, you deny reason. Well, you could deny reason. That's okay. But then you can't say anything else either.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to have some confidence in reason in order to make the statement that this that something came from nothing. Well, no, it can't. So I take these as philosophic arguments, and I think those philosophic arguments against naturalism are very strong. I'd like to point to a book by David Bentley Hart called The Experience of God, Being, Consciousness, and Bliss. It's a recent book published by the Yale University Press. David Bentley Hart is an Eastern Orthodox, and he has one of the most clearest expressions of this kind of argument, critique of naturalism. It's a devastating critique of all the naturalistic explanations to say that evolutionary science or science in itself somehow has proven excellent information or excellent data that God doesn't exist. I think that argument is a very, very poor argument. In other words, the rationale given by the atheists, I think, is irrational.
Mm. Now, in your book, you talk about the role of intuition and what you term sudden apprehension. What exactly do you mean by those things, and how do they prove the existence of God and give us a defense for the faith?
They don't prove the existence of God, but they are experiences of the God who exists, and they're direct experiences. They're experiences that there is a presence in the universe, a presence in my life, a presence wherever you are in this room, in the universe, and beyond the stars, as these signals of transcendence are signaled to us, and we respond with this sudden apprehension that there's got to be more than material in the world. It can be a baby's cry. It can be a baby's smile. It can be the stars at night. There's just too many of these kinds of experiences which can't be, or I should say, are very poorly understood by the naturalist. The naturalist simply says, well, it's our machinery gone crazy.
Something's happening with our serotonin.
Yeah. Right. Our synapses are missynapping.
And so these are just kind of ghost images that are caused by brain chemistry, and there's really nothing to them.
I don't have any quarrel with someone who says, well, your brain is responding materially and giving you these kinds of experiences, but it isn't the brain that's in charge. It's not okay. The machinery doing it.
So explain that. Take us a bit deeper into that.
Well, show me a thought. You can't do it. One of my friends says, well, here, for every thought, you can find a system, a scientific description of the brain in that particular state from which that particular thought came. But that's not the thought.
Not the thought itself.
No. Mm. Now, he accuses me of being a dualist. I'm perfectly happy to say that the universe is more than matter, and that this more than matter turns out to be a kind of unified conception. But I'm a dualist in the sense that the material of the universe is not the only thing that's there. Mm. And the thought that it is there is not itself material. Mm. So science, or the statements of science, are themselves not material. Well, they're words, they're sounds, but they're not the signification.
When you talk to the average person, the average American, it appears to me, and you correct me if you think I'm wrong here, that so few of us, including Christians, unfortunately, are really grappling with these issues. They have kind of crowded out the life of the mind with busyness, with entertainment. And so 24 hours a day, they're either, working, eating, sleeping in front of the tube, and they never really take time to contemplate. They never really take time to consider the transcendent. That seems like a real denial of how human beings were meant to exist and meant to thrive.
Well, we live, unfortunately, even everyone lives in a box. The box of one's own personal experience. And if you But you can choose within that box which personal experience to indulge in. You can play, go, you know, play sports, go to sports, do that sort of thing. You can watch television. You can listen to Christian radio. All sorts of stuff that you can do. But if you cut off, if you shut the door or don't open the door to the possibility of there being a transcendent, you probably will have a hard time ever having one of these signals of transcendence. But start reading the Bible. Start looking at the universe as the glory of God expressed in material form. Start looking at the problem of evil from the standpoint of a God who really wants something else to be in the world but allows history to develop. Think about what's going on and give yourself a good a dose of prayer and Bible study and worship. It's the people who don't do any of those things who are the ones who somehow are capable of living, but I think they live by being diverted. That was Pascal's term in the 17th century, diversion. For him, it was wine, women, song, and gambling. Now, you add to that TV, sports, and so forth to ours, and we're much worse off than Pascal.
It's interesting. I was in New Zealand recently, and of course that country had a great Christian tradition, and to see all the beautiful cathedrals, and yet I was asking a Christian couple, I said, well, you know, obviously this is a very postmodern country now, and they said, yeah, they said in New Zealand the religion today is rugby, barbecues, sailing, and beer. And in effect, that's what people, other than when they're not working, they're being diverted, as you just pointed out, and diverted from really true meaning and purpose in life. And it's tragic.
Well, I'm going to be diverted this afternoon at 2:30 watching the Little League World
World Series. And I would say that's a great diversion. That's beautiful. We're talking to Dr. James Sire about his new book, which is called Apologetics Beyond Reason, Why Seeing Really Is Believing. We're going to take a quick break, and if you would like a copy of Dr. Sire's book for your library, your church library, give us a call right now at 1-877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH. We'll put you into a drawing. And at the end of the hour, we have 4 copies to give away. We'll take a quick break and be back with one final segment with Dr. Sire after this.
Now back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. So great to have you with us today here on the Faith Radio Network. We appreciate you taking us along wherever you might be throughout the Upper Midwest. By the way, you can find our entire program schedule at myfaithradio.com and check out some of our weekday programs. My gracious, we have some of the finest Bible teachers in the world on this network. And, of course, our great local programming, Austin Hill in the morning. We've got Neil Stavem at noon, Susie Larson at 3 in the afternoon, and you will be edified, you will be challenged, you will grow. It's just a great opportunity for you, whether you're at work, whether you're driving around, whether you're home, to grow as a believer and to really understand what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. Our guest is Dr. James Sire, and we've been talking about his book, Apologetics Beyond Reason, Why Seeing Really Is Believing. And before we go, Dr. Sire has another book out called We Are Not Alone. I love this description. This is just a little tease for you. Early evening, a young boy alone on his pony on the rim of the Nebraska sandhills. 3 darkening thunderclouds rising higher and higher on the horizon. An electric atmosphere, a quickening light cooling breeze. A slight shiver, and the boy wonders, am I being pursued by the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost? That's just a little taste of his book, We Are Not Alone, which I think ties in very much so with this new InterVarsity book, Why Seeing Really Is Believing. Tell us a little bit about Echoes of a Voice, We Are Not Alone, Dr. Sire.
Well, Echoes of a Voice is published by Cascade, and you can get it through Amazon. I'll put that in. If you write to InterVarsity Press, they'll say, what? What? excuse me. Echoes of a Voice is replete with stories like the one I just told of my own experience from a wide variety of people, from philosophers to ordinary folk to people who are surprised. Most of us are surprised by these. They don't happen because we are looking for them. But if we're in the right place and we have our ears open and our eyes open, God can show himself to us with his presence, and if it's really a direct experience, it is no argument that goes along with this. And it is what it seems to me that heaven will be something like this, living in the presence of God. And some of that you can experience here, and some of that has the kind of impact that will lead, that does lead a number of people to become Christians. Longing for Zainzuth, the longing and the desire that C.S. Lewis felt for the realms of Nordic mythology eventually gets realized in his coming to faith in Christ.
Hmm. Who are some of the other individuals' experiences that you share in Echoes of a Voice?
Of my own?
No, who are some of the other individuals?
Oh, I'm
other,
sorry.
Other
Alvin Plantinga is a philosopher. Oh my!
Alvin? What is Alvin? What do you say about Alvin's own?
Well,
experience?
Alvin philosopher. Is a philosopher. One of the most well-known Christian philosophers, and accepted as that by people who are not Christians. He was a student for a few months at Harvard University, and one night as getting dark, and he is passing by Widener Library at Harvard, he gets this sudden sense of there being the presence of God in the whole of reality. And he is astounded by that. And he said from there on in, he's never really had any doubt about the pursuit that he was already on to understand Christianity better.
Some beautiful experiences shared in this book, and certainly your own. And it's wonderful to balance. You think about your work in apologetics and very much a reasoned, rational defense for the faith, and then this more experiential book, both of these books, which dive into the experiential. It's a great way to balance out our Christian experience so that we don't just become one-sided.
I hope that's true.
Well, we appreciate you so much. What is next for Dr. James Sire? Are you still actively traveling, speaking, and teaching?
I wish I could. I've just been invited to do something on Christian epistemology in a secular high school in Omaha, and I've had to turn it down. I'm just not capable of traveling anymore. I have 14 stents. That should tell you something. Failed bypass surgery.
Well, we certainly will be praying for you, sir.
Thank you.
We appreciate you so much and your commitment to truth and for what you share in these wonderful books, starting with The Universe Next Door so many years ago, and then these latest books. Again, the books are Apologetics Beyond Reason, Why Seeing Really Is Believing. That one's from InterVarsity. And then this other new book from Cascade, which is Echoes of a Voice, We Are Not Alone, by Dr. James Sire. Dr. Sire, thank you for spending an hour of your time with us today. May the Lord continue to guide you and direct you and bless you in your work.
Thank you, Bill.
Well, that wraps up our program for today. We thank you for joining us here on the Faith Radio Network. We have Neil Stavem's Connecting Faith Weekend Edition coming up next. And then later on this afternoon, my good buddy Austin Hill, who does the morning show on Faith Radio, has a special program that he does every Saturday called Austin's Big World of Small Business, where he dives into some of the faith aspects of economics, of business, of work, even vacations. Yes, he's talked about that on his program before, and that's coming up right after Neil's weekend edition of Connecting Faith. Thank you for spending part of your Saturday with us. Don't forget, September 9th to the 12th, Faith Radio's Fall Pledge Drive Share coming up here on the Faith Radio Network. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Dr. Bill Meyer Live. If you'd like more information about this show, you can visit our program page at myfaithradio.com.